There's your risk for you. Robo-voice. Technology is clearing away some of the non-conversational conversations we used to have. Hello, how are you? Fine, thanks. What can I do for you today? Is that it then? Okay, you have a good day, repeated 12 times an hour, 40 hours a week. An ATM will do just fine, thanks. Yes, we lose some human contact, and there are certainly places where the brief dialogue with the bank teller is part of a social fabric that shouldn't be sundered, part of the ancient marketplace that has survived. If that's true for you, then you'll avoid ATMs. But in many instances, automated transactions are liberating people from semi-automatic human behaviors. In other cases, the automation afforded by the web is increasing the quality of offline marketplaces. For example, in part to compete with Amazon.com, local bookstores are enhancing their conversational accoutrements, and many of us appreciate them all the more precisely because of the frictionless ease of acquiring books from Amazon. On the positive side, by acknowledging that, inevitably, many people speak for a particular company in many different ways, the company can address one of the most important and difficult questions. How can a large company have conversations with hundreds of millions of real people? First, the conversations don't all have to be truly interactive. Few people insist on personal service immediately from every website. We're delighted to look through the frequently asked questions and README files to find our answers. Answers culled from the real interactions between the company and its market. When a conversation is required, or even just desired, being able to count upon a rich range of corporate spokespeople is crucial. That's the only way a growing business can satisfy the market's demand for conversation. For example, at Western Digital's website, WDC.com, users can post technical questions about the company's hard disk drives. Most of these questions are naturally about drives that don't work. A Western Digital support person will post an answer, often within hours, and the entire exchange is open to public view, unfiltered. As a result, customers with problems can usually find a previous exchange that answers their questions. Sure, visitors to the site find out that not all Western Digital drives work flawlessly forever, but this is hardly a newsflash. More important, they learn that Western Digital has enough confidence in its products to let customers air their gripes, and that if a drive breaks, it'll get diagnosed and fixed at the speed of the web. And, perhaps most important, they see that the company's customers and enthusiasts care enough to dive in. Could a company ask for better living testimonials? Could customers ask for a livelier, more reality-based source of information? If you want to hear the sound of the new marketing, listen to these conversations coming from inside, outside, over and above even the hardest-shelled companies that still think marketing means lobbing messages into crowds. Here is the same sound our ancestors heard in those ancient marketplaces where people spoke for themselves about what mattered to them. How to talk. We're all learning to talk anew. We're all going to get it right and get it wrong. Two events in the fall of 1994 still serve as good cases in point for crisis management. In one case, resolute ivory tower isolation caused a major disaster. In the other, real conversation among concerned individuals saved the day. First, an anatomy of a disaster. Through the 1980s and early 1990s, CompuServe hosted many of the best online forums. One of these professional salons was the EE Times Forum, hosted by Electronic Engineering Times, the top magazine for the people who design and work with computer chips. It's a safe bet that most of the participants used Intel-based computers and engineered computers with Intel inside. Yet when news of a bug in an early Pentium chip was first found and posted on the forum, nobody seemed to take it too seriously. They joked about it a bit, but took it in stride. After all, bugs in chips are nothing new. But all of them clearly were looking for Intel to jump in and talk about it. However, there was radio silence from Intel until Alex Wolf, an EE Times reporter, wrote about the bug in his magazine. Soon the major media picked up the story and all hell broke loose. To deal with this crisis, Intel CEO Andy Grove posted something on the forum that read like a papal encyclical on how Intel works. This included a description of a caste system that drew a line between those who should be concerned about such a bug and those who should not, and offered to replace the defective chips for the first group. This didn't sit well with anybody, but the forum members were tolerant at first. They wanted to get to the bottom of this thing, so they attempted to engage Grove on the matter. After all, he had showed up. He must have been willing to talk. But it quickly became obvious that Grove was just posting a notice. The big guy was not going to take part in a conversation. So when Intel got shellacked in the press, little help came from what should have been company friends in the engineering community. After all, these were Intel's real customers. They understood how bugs happen. They were articulate and authoritative, but they were just as silent for Grove as Grove had been for them. Intel was publicly embarrassed into recalling every one of the defective chips, and estimates for reputation damage ran into many millions. Meanwhile, over in CompuServe's travel forum, another bad PR event was taking shape. This one involved United Airlines, which was experiencing a bumpy takeoff with its new Shuttle by United service. Like the EE Times forum, the travel forum had serious participants: high-mileage flyers, pilots, air traffic controllers, travel agents, and airline personnel from every level. If you could hook up a meter to the forum and measure goodwill, the needle reading for Shuttle by United at takeoff was way over on the negative side. Luggage was being lost, 3 times for one passenger. Passenger loading was chaotic. Customers were unhappy. Then one United worker, one of those owners United's ads talked about so much at the time, jumped in and simply started to help out. The response was remarkable. Here are a few examples. "Good to see someone at United interested. Nice to have a UAL person to chat with. Thanks. As a 100K flyer, I'm glad to see one of you online here. I am a pilot for United, and I thank you for taking the time to answer all of these questions about the shuttle. Nice to see a UA employee on and participating instead of just lurking. As a UA 1KFF, top-grade frequent flyer, and a Pass Plus holder, I appreciate your time and interest in the forum. Don't leave United. You're important to us. Your comments are helpful. You make a difference." This kind of conversation moved the meter all the way over to the positive side, just because one company guy took on the burden of talking with customers and trying to solve their problems. One guy. Then one day, the same UA employee posted a notice that said, "Due to a conflict with corporate communication policies at United Airlines of employees responding to issues of any nature without the explicit direction of the communications division, I will not be participating any longer. I hope this situation changes in the future. Until then, direct any concerns to the Consumer Affairs Department at United's World Headquarters." You can imagine what followed. United got flamed royally by their employees' new friends on the forum. But, unlike Intel, United stayed in the conversation. A United higher-up jumped in and quickly communicated United's willingness to learn this new form of market relations. The original United correspondent and the higher-up both stayed in the conversation and started to work things out. The needle went back over to the positive side, and nobody ever heard bad news about the Shuttle by United bug. Lessons learned? The party's already started. You can join or not. If you don't, your silence will be taken as arrogance, stupidity, meanness, or all three. If you're going to join, don't do it as a legal entity or wearing your cloak of officialdom. Join it as a person with a name, a point of view, a sense of humor, and passion. Marketing craft. The market started out as a place where people talked about what they cared about, in voices as individual as the craft goods on the table between them. As the distance between producer and consumer lengthened, so grew the gap between our business voice and our authentic voice. Marketing became a profession, an applied science, the engineering of desirable responses through the application of calibrated stimuli, including the occasional axe in the head. Marketing isn't going to go away, nor should it. But it needs to evolve, rapidly and thoroughly, for markets have become networked and now know more than business, learn faster than business, are more honest than business, and are a hell of a lot more fun than business. The voices are back, and voice brings craft, work by unique individuals motivated by passion. What's happening to the market is precisely what should and will happen to marketing. Marketing needs to become a craft. Recall that craft workers listen to the material they're forming, shaping the pot to the feel of the clay, designing the house to fit with and even reveal the landscape. The stuff of marketing is the market itself. Marketing can't become a craft until it can hear the new, the old, sound of its markets. By listening, marketing will relearn how to talk. Chapter 5. The Hyperlinked Organization by David Weinberger. Business sounds different these days. The words at meetings have an edge. The language used with customers is unfiltered. The emails are pithy, often piercing. Where once bombastic self-confidence got you taken seriously, now being funny does. In fact, there's laughter everywhere, although it signals insight and bitterness as often as delight. Sometimes you could swear you hear children's laughter in the background over the sounds of cooking and cockatiels and the UPS truck arriving. Beneath the formalities of business, the committees, the schedules, the payroll checks, the spray of assignments falling from above, there's a buzz, no, the sound of twigs breaking underfoot as paths are trod on the way to human connection. The most amazing thing, you can tell who's talking by listening to the voice. People are beginning to sound like themselves again. Intranet Apocalypso. You may not hear any of this at your place of work, but if the web has touched your business, and it has, then the sound is there. The odd thing is that you almost certainly have to be making some of the new sound to hear it. Otherwise, it passes for noise, like an overtone of the 60-cycle thrum of modern business at its automated, time-slicing best. You hear it or you don't. You get it or you don't. The gulf that is opened in companies is about the size of the human heart. That's what makes the situation so ripe for humor and anger and absurdity. Consider this. From the other side of the gulf opened by the web, virtually all of the structures that management identifies as being the business itself seem to be bizarre artifacts of earlier times, like wearing a powdered wig and codpiece to the company picnic. The gulf the web opens is, ironically, that of connection. Without anyone asking for it, the web has given the people inside an organization easy access to one another in a rich variety of ways. They can send email to one person, to a steady group, to a dynamic team, to the entire sales force, or just to the board of directors. They can post creative, informative pages that express their interests, correct the mistakes in the official technical documentation, or point to the industry analyst's report the company doesn't want anyone to read. They can write a zine that parodies the company line savagely and without let-up. They can play backgammon online or blow up their colleagues in a ruthless game of Quake, in which the guy who never speaks at meetings routinely turns his manager into animated meat chunks. They can also find every piece of information about the company and its competitors, shop for a car, or learn how to play the blues like Buddy Guy. The web, in short, has led every wired person in your organization to expect direct connections not only to information, but also to the truth spoken in human voices. And they expect to be able to find what they need and do what they need without any further help from people who dress better than they do. This has happened not because of a management theory or a best-selling business book, but because the web reaches everyone with a computer and a telephone line on her desk. So the gulf opens between those who are connected and those who think an office with a door is a sign of success. The gulf is one of expectations, and expectations always guide perception. As a result, the company thinks it's doing one thing while accomplishing the direct opposite with its connected employees. For example, the company communicates with me through a newsletter and company meetings meant to lift up my morale. In fact, I know from my email pen pals that it's telling me happy talk lies, and I find that quite depressing. The company org chart shows me who does what so I know how to get things done. In fact, the org chart is an expression of a power structure. It is red tape. It is a map of whom to avoid. The company manages my work to make sure that all tasks are coordinated and the company is operating efficiently. In fact, the inflexible goals imposed from on high keep me from following what my craft expertise tells me I really ought to be doing. The company provides me with a career path so I'll see a productive future in the business. In fact, I've figured out that because the org chart narrows at the top, most career paths necessarily have to be dead ends. The company provides me with all the information I need to make good decisions. In fact, this information is selected to support a decision or worldview in which I have no investment. Statistics and industry surveys are lobbed like anti-aircraft fire to disguise the fact that while we have lots of data, we have no understanding. The company is goal-oriented so that the path from here to there is broken into small, well-marked steps that can be tracked and managed. In fact, if I keep my head down and accomplish my goals, I won't add the type of value I'm capable of. I need to browse. I even need to play. Without play, only shit happens. With play, serendipity happens. The company gives me deadlines so that we ship product on time, maintaining our integrity. In fact, working to arbitrary deadlines makes me ship poor quality content. My management doesn't have to use a club to get me to do my job. Where's the trust, baby? The company looks at customers as adversaries who must be won over. In fact, the ones I've been exchanging email with are very cool and enthusiastic about exactly the same thing that got me into this company. You know, I'd rather talk with them than with my manager. The company works in an office building in order to bring together all of the things I need to get my job done and to avoid distracting me. In fact, more and more of what I need is outside the corporate walls, and when I really want to get something done, I go home. The company rewards me for being a professional who acts and behaves in a, well, professional manner, following certain unwritten rules about the coefficient of permitted variation in dress, politics, shoe style, expression of religion, and the relating of humorous stories. In fact, I learn who to trust, whom I can work with creatively and productively, only by getting past the professional act. Something's gone wrong, or maybe something now is starting to go right. What's wrong isn't trivial. It isn't fixed with dress-down Fridays, health food in the cafeteria, or learning to pretend to look into the eyes of the trembling subordinate you're condescending to chat up on the way in from the parking lot. The power structure, the politics, the sociology, even the spirituality of work has a sick, sour smell to it. But you don't need big words. It all begins with pictures. That's why our hairy-backed ancestors were sketching bison on the wall. They were learning to see. So let's think instead about the basic picture we have of business. Inside Fort Business. Somewhere along the line, we confused going to work with building a fort. Strip away the financial jibber-jabber and the management corpo-speak, and here's our fundamental image of business. It's in an imposing office building that towers over the landscape. Inside is everything we need. And that's good because the outside is dangerous. We are under siege by our competitors, and even by our partners and customers. Thank God for the thick, high walls. The king rules. If we have a wise king, we prosper. The king has a court. The dukes, viscounts, and other subluminaries each receive their authority from the king. The king even countenances an official fool, within limits. We each have our role, our place. If we each do the job assigned to us by the king's minions, our fort will beat all those other stinking forts. And then we will have succeeded, or, thinking it's the same thing, we will say we have won. We get to dance a stupid jig while chanting, "Number one! Number one!" The fort is, at its heart, a place apart. We report there every morning and spend the next 8, 10, or 12 hours inaccessible to the real world. The portcullis drops not only to keep out our enemies, but to separate us from distractions such as our families. As the drawbridge goes up behind us, we become business people, different enough from our normal selves that when we first bring our children to the office, they've been known to hide under our desk, crying. Within this world, the web looks like a medium that exists to allow Fort Business to publish online marketing materials and make credit card sales easier than ever. Officially, this point of view is known as denial. The web isn't primarily a medium for information, marketing, or sales. It's a world in which people meet, talk, build, fight, love, and play. In fact, the web world is bigger than the business world and is swallowing the business world whole. The vague rumblings you're hearing are the sounds of digestion. The change is so profound that it's not merely a negation of the current situation. You can't just put a big knot in front of Fort Business and say, "Ah, the walls are coming down." No, the true opposite of a fort isn't an unwalled city. It's a conversation. Hyperlinks subvert hierarchy. Fort Business's assumptions are being challenged by a meek little thing, a hyperlink. How could something so small alter the fundamentals of business life? Easy. This wee beastie represents an important change in how pieces are put together. And since all of life is about putting pieces together, this isn't a wee thing at all. Sure, businesses are legal entities, but that's just a piece of paper. In fact, the real business is the set of connections among people. Modern business almost universally has chosen a particular type of togetherness, a hierarchy. There are two distinguishing marks of a hierarchy. It has a top and a bottom, and the top is narrower than the bottom. Power flows from the top, and there are fewer and fewer people as you move up the food chain. This not only makes the line of authority crystal clear, it also enhances the allure of success by making it into an exclusive club. As La Rochefoucauld once said, quote, "It is not enough that I succeed. It is also necessary that my friends fail," unquote. No wonder so many of us stare at our bare feet in the morning and wonder why we're putting on our socks. A couple of other points about business hierarchies. First, they assume, along with Ayn Rand and poorly socialized adolescents, that the fundamental unit of life is the individual. This is despite the evidence of our senses that individuals only emerge from groups, groups like families and communities. You know, it really does take a village to raise a child, just like it takes a corporation to raise an ass-kisser. But the web obviously isn't predicated on individuals. It's a web. It's about the connections. And on the World Wide Web, the connections are hyperlinks. It's not just documents that get hyperlinked in the new world of the web. People do. Organizations do. The web, in the form of a corporate intranet, puts everyone in touch with every piece of information and with everyone else inside the organization and beyond. The potential connections are vast. Hyperlinks are the connections made by real individuals based on what they care about and what they know, the paths that emerge because that's where the feet are walking, as opposed to the highways bulldozed into existence according to a centralized plan. Hyperlinks have no symmetry, no plan. They are messy. More can be added, old ones can disappear, and nothing else has to change. Compare this to your latest reorganization, where you sat down with the org chart and your straight edge and worried about holes and imbalances and neatness, for heaven's sake. A messy org chart is the devil's playground, after all. Second, business hierarchies are power structures only because fundamentally they're based on fear. Org charts are pyramids. The ancient pharaohs built their pyramids out of the fear of human mortality. Today's business pharaohs build their pyramidal organizations out of fear of human fallibility. They're afraid of being exposed as frightened little boys, fallible and uncertain. Understanding through hyperlinks. Ever since Aristotle, we understand what something is by seeing what category it's in and how it differs from other things in that category. For example, humans are in the category of animals, but we are the rational ones. This knowledge hierarchy constrains things to a single category. In a hyperlinked world, however, things can be understood by reference, via metaphor, to other things, and can be like more than one thing at a time. If you change the way we understand things, you've changed something very significant indeed. To be human is to be imperfect. We die. We make mistakes. Sometimes we run from our fallibility by being decisive, but doubt is the natural human state, and decisiveness, more addictive than anything you might shoot into your veins, is often based on a superstitious belief in the magic of action. Within the pyramid, we have defined roles and responsibilities. We tell ourselves that this is so the business will run efficiently, but in fact, having a role brings us the great comfort of having a turf where we're pretty confident we're not going to be shown up, except maybe by that ambitious jerk on the fourth floor, but we've figured out a way to hook his brains out through his nose, which should delay him at least for a little while. Of course, dividing the business up into fanatically defended turfs doesn't really protect anyone from fallibility and uncertainty, the very things that mark us as humans. So here's some news for today's business pharaohs. Your pyramid is being replaced by hyperlinks. It was built on sand anyway. The web liberates business from the fear of being exposed as human, even against its will. It throws everyone into immediate connection with everyone else without the safety net of defined roles and authorities, but it also sets the expectation that you'll make human-sized mistakes rather frequently. Now that you've lost the trappings of authority, and you find yourself standing next to the junior graphic designer, for God's sake, and you can't hide behind your business card, what the hell are you going to do? You're going to talk with her. You're going to have a conversation, and if you harumph and try to make sure she knows that you're very important by the power vested in you, by the power that vested in you, well, she's going to laugh once out loud and five times in email and tell everyone else what an asshole you are. You see, the hyperlinks that replace the org chart as the primary structure of the organization are in fact conversations. They are the paths talk takes, and a business is, more than anything else, the set of conversations going on. Business is a conversation because the defining work of a business is conversation, literally. And knowledge workers are simply those people whose job consists of having interesting conversations. Can I supersize that? Have it on my desk by the morning. There's no I in team, and laughing at your manager's unfunny jokes are not conversations. Conversations are where ideas happen and partnerships are formed. Sometimes they create commitments, in Fernando Flores' sense, but more often they're pulling people through fields of common interest with no known destination. The structure of conversations is always hyperlinked and is never hierarchical. To have a conversation, you have to be comfortable being human, acknowledging you don't have all the answers, being eager to learn from someone else and to build new ideas together. You can only have a conversation if you're not afraid to be wrong. Otherwise, you're not conversing, you're just declaiming, speechifying, or reading what's on the PowerPoints. To converse, you have to be willing to be wrong in front of another person. Conversations occur only between equals. The time your boss's boss asked you at a meeting about your project's deadline was not a conversation. The time you sat with your boss's boss for an hour in the Polynesian-themed bar while on a business trip and you really talked, got past the corporate bullshit, told each other the truth about the dangers ahead, and ended up talking about your kids, that maybe was a conversation. Conversations subvert hierarchy. Hyperlinks subvert hierarchy. Being a human being among others subverts hierarchy. Bottom up. The web is undoubtedly a part of your business plans. You've got it safely contained, under control, managed. Why, your organization has probably already installed a corporate intranet so it can publish the human resource policies that no one read on paper to people who now won't read them on screen. Excellent. Yes, your centralized corporate intranet has eliminated some paper and is making management feel vaguely cool, but that's not the web that's going to shake the foundations of your fort. While you've been hiring consultants to create a slick corporate intranet, establishing policies about who gets to post what, and creating a chain of command to ensure that only appropriate and approved materials show up on your internal corporate homepage, your engineers, scientists, researchers, hell, even the marketing folks, have been creating little websites for their own use. No one is controlling what's posted on them except the people doing the posting. No one is making sure that the corporate logo is in the right place. No one is making sure that the writing is official, officious, and as dull as the pencil drawer of a recently downsized middle manager. The real party got underway while you were still setting up the banners at the corporate prom. This year's prom theme, Responsibility in a Web Age. For example, by the time Sun Microsystems got around to counting, they had 800 intranets. And when Texas Instruments put in their corporate intranet, they invited everyone who had one already in place to register with the top-down one. Within a few months, 250 internal sites had registered, and no one knows how many unregistered ones there were. Even a top-down intranet can take on a bottom-up feel, as happened at Lucent Technologies, according to an article in the Wall Street Journal. After Lucent brought together a product development team of 500 engineers across 3 continents and 13 time zones, it watched dozens of them insert their own pages into the project intranet. Some of these pages related directly to the project, others were strictly personal, like, "Hey, look at this picture of me and my dog." Either way, the project took on a human cast that never would have been present otherwise. In the end, the team leader attributed the success of the project in no small part to, quote, "the ultimate democracy of the web," unquote. Granted, these are technology companies, but you don't have to be a technical genius to create an intranet. If someone wants to share some information, they can turn their computer into a web server. It's free, and it's getting easier every day. The intranet revolution is bottom-up. There's no going back. If a company doesn't recognize this, the top-down intranet it puts in can breed the type of cynicism that results in ugly bathroom graffiti and mysterious golfing cart accidents. The intranet's under-the-radar screen and the rest of the net panoply, including email, mailing lists, and discussion groups, ignore the corporate blather and ass-covering pronouncements. Instead, these new web conversations are actually being used to get some work done. The character of the web. It's weird, but not totally unexpected. It turns out that the web is infecting organizations with the characteristics of its own architecture. So if you want to know what a hyperlinked organization looks like, look at what the web itself is like. What's the web's character? You can slice it into 7 basic themes. 1. Hyperlinked. Before the web, computer networks were laid out in advance like well-planned cities. Who got connected to whom and how was all part of the master plan. And once you were connected, there was a recognizable central authority responsible for the whole shebang. The web isn't even a little like that. The web literally consists of hundreds of millions of pages hyperlinked together by the author of each individual page. Anyone can plug in, and any page can be linked to any other without asking permission. The web is constantly spinning itself, many small pieces loosely joining themselves as they see fit. 2. Decentralized. No one is in charge of the net. There is no central clearinghouse that dispatches all requests and approves all submissions. No one ordered the web built. There is no CEO of the web. There is no one to sue. There's no one to complain to. There's no one to fix it when it breaks. There's no one to thank. 3. Hyper time. Internet time is, famously, 7 times the velocity of normal time, and yet we use the leisurely verb browse to describe our behavior on the web because in the virtual world, I feel I can move about at my own pace, exploring when and where I want. I can take a quick look at a site and come back later without having to find another parking space, go to the end of the line, or pay a second entry fee. The web puts the control of my time into my hands. 4. Open direct access. The net provides what feels like direct access to everyone else on the net and to every piece of information that's ever been posted. If you want to go to a page, you just click on the link and boom, you're there. The fact that this might have required, beneath the surface, 30 hops among servers in places you never heard of is completely irrelevant. You don't see the hops, you just see the page. There's nothing standing between you and the rest of the world of people and pages. 5. Rich data. The currency of the web isn't green bar printouts of facts and stats, it's pages. Humans have been creating pages since the invention of paper and dirty water. Pages, or documents as we sometimes say, are extraordinarily complex ways of presenting information. Typically, they tell you as much about the author as about their topic, a big change from the pre-web information environment that aimed at generating faceless data. 6. Broken. Because the web is by far the largest, most complex network ever built, and because no one owns it or controls it, it is always going to be, in the words of Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web, quote, a little bit broken, unquote. 7. Borderless. Because traditional networks were concerned as much with security as with access, it was usually made clear where your stuff ended and other people's stuff began. The web, on the other hand, was designed so that you can include a link to a page without having to get the author's permission. Thus, on the web, it is often hard to tell exactly where the boundaries are. From these characteristics of the technical architecture of the web come the changes that are transforming your business. The hyperlinking of the organization. Your organization is becoming hyperlinked, whether you like it or not. It's bottom-up. It's unstoppable. Despite the wet stink of fear, you ought to be delighted. Hyperlinked organizations are closer to their markets, act faster, and acquire the valuable survival skill of learning to swerve. Of course, they are also impossible to manage, although they can be unmanaged, and you'll have to give up your pretense of power, status, and lordliness. But then, as the old saying has it, you can't make an omelet without nuking the existing social order. Here's the drill for the rest of this chapter. We've just discussed 7 key characteristics of the web. Now we're going to go through them one at a time in order. No talking in the hallways, and please stand to the right to enable those in a hurry to pass, to see what's happening inside organizations touched by the web, that is, all organizations to one degree or another. Let's put the hyper back into hyperlinks. Here's one example of how things work in a hyperlinked organization. You're a sales rep in the Southwest who has a customer with a product problem. You know that the Southwest tech support person happens not to know anything about this problem. In fact, she's a flat-out bozo. So, to do what's right for your customer, you go outside the prescribed channels and pull together the support person from the Northeast, a product manager you respect, and a senior engineer who's been responsive in the past. No good deed goes unpunished. Via email, or by building a mini website on an intranet, you initiate a discussion, research numbers, check out competitive solutions, and quickly solve the customer's problem, all without ever notifying the appropriate authorities of what you're doing, because all they'll do is try to force you back into the official channels. It's a little thing, but it's a big change in the ground rules of work. The official structure is of little use to you. Instead, your network of trusted colleagues becomes paramount. Your effectiveness depends upon how networked you are, how hyperlinked you are. The hyperlinked teams you form may not be as project-centered as in the example above. As organizations become hyperlinked, they spawn hyperlinked committees, hyperlinked task forces, hyperlinked affiliations, hyperlinked interest groups, hyperlinked communities, hyperlinked cheering squads, hyperlinked pen pals, and hyperlinked attitudes. Humans seem to fill up every available social niche just as nature itself abhors an ecological vacuum. These hyperlinked relationships are, like the web of hyperlinked documents, a shifting context of links of varying importance and quality. They are self-asserting, not requiring anyone else's authority to be put in place. And the value of the individual node, to a large degree, depends upon the node's links. This last point is a big shift. Links have value by pointing away from themselves to some other site. All web pages derive some value from the links on them. A page with no links is literally a dead end on the web. In fact, the single most visited site on the web, Yahoo, derives almost all of its value not from what it contains, but from what it points to. Yet our understanding of the nature of knowledge, education, and expertise is bound up with things that contain value, not with things that point you out of themselves to find value elsewhere. Books get their value from their content. Education is the transfer of content into the receptacle that is the student. And an expert is someone who contains a lot of information, like a book contains information. In fact, experts are people who can write books. But with today's huge increase in the amount of information, you can be an expert only in something sliced so thin that often it's trivial. Increasingly, a useful expert is not someone with, containing, all the answers, but someone who knows where to find answers. The new experts have value not by centralizing information and control, but by being great pointers to other people and to useful, current information. In short, your most valuable employee is likely to be the one who, in response to a question, doesn't give a concrete answer in a booming voice, but who says, "You should talk to Larry and check Janice's project plan. Oh, and there's a mailing list on this topic I ran into a couple of weeks ago." How could you hope to capture this on an org chart? And how do you compensate people fairly if their value depends upon their participation in a shifting set of hyperlinked associations? How do you hire great hyperlinked people? How could this ever be expressed on a resume? Great questions, because there aren't clear answers yet. Epochal changes are not Q&A sessions. We're at the beginning of the biggest Q since the Industrial Revolution. It's a time to make things up, try them out, fail 1,000 times, and laugh at how stupid you look. The urge to solve the problem is nothing but the voice of the old command and control psychosis trying to reassert itself. Premature elucidation, the plight of men who come to answers way too soon. Decentralizing the fort. Traditionally, business is an indoor sport. Businesses by their very nature are centralized, or so we think. Even if you are a global enterprise, your organization consists of a headquarters with regional offices. A business is, after all, a bringing together of talented people who agree to work to achieve some common goals. We've assumed that together means we have to centralize power, control, and resources. But there are lots of ways to be together. Metaphorical togetherness. We often assume that complex projects can only be accomplished through centralized planning and control. It worked for building the Hoover Dam, after all, not to mention World War II. But of course, it only works for some types of wars in some types of places. And the builders of the Hoover Dam aimed at creating a massive physical object with delicate dependencies so that there was only one way to succeed and many ways to fail. A marriage is a far more complex project than any business partnership, and centralized control doesn't work real well there. Raising a family is likewise a complex project that cannot be centrally organized or planned. And, of course, the most complex network ever imagined, the World Wide Web, has been implemented without any central control whatsoever. But is a business more like a family than a war? Absolutely. Wars are won and then are over, but companies don't declare victory and disband the troops. And although both wars and companies have missions, companies don't ever issue a press release that says, "Omnico is proud to announce that on June 23, we accomplished our mission of being the world's leading supplier of low-temperature oil to the miniature locomotive industry, So we are now demobilizing so that our brave men and women can rejoin their families. Good night and God bless. No, families and businesses are open-ended commitments. Suppose running a business is more like farming than like waging war. Perhaps the real aim of business is to build a place that provides a high yield over the long term, responding to the sometimes vast changes in the environment. Command and control don't work when you're cultivating the wilderness, when you're experiencing an ecology of surplus, when changes happen faster than response times, when you're homesteading, not marching to battle. Why is it even necessary to have to point out something so obvious? That's not a rhetorical question. We all know enough about the inequities of history to smell something suspicious about the insistence on centralized control. Control and management are the mantras of the people who are in power, who judge personal success by power, and who use power to keep themselves at the top. Org charts are written by the victors, but hyperlinks are created by people finding other people they trust and, yes, in some ways, love. Self-reliance. In a decentralized environment, people figure out that they have to do things themselves. Indeed, they want to do things themselves. This is a well-known phenomenon in customer support. People would rather find the answers themselves on your website than have the answers delivered to them by picking up the phone. This may sound like a control issue, but in fact it is about time. By browsing your support website, not only can I choose when I'm going to look and how long before I'll give up, I can click through some screens, work on something else, eat lunch, maybe even bookmark the page, and come back to it tomorrow. I can complete the task on my own schedule. Mission statements. Mission statements are directed to customers and prospects. That's why they don't contain the words, "and make us filthy rich." But they're also part of a conceptual hierarchy that mirrors the power hierarchy. Excuse me, org chart. At the top is the mission statement. And it begat the strategy, and the strategy begat the tactics, and the tactics begat the objectives, that begat the tasks, that begat the people in cubicles, who no longer beget children because they're working all weekend to try to finish the bleeping assignments they've been given to serve the all-powerful mission statement. If you want to know where to find the real corporate point of view and values, look to the stories that are told off hours when folks are just talking. In short, at the strategic offsite where you're drafting your new mission statement, if you're given a choice between bringing in a consultant or beer, choose the beer. It shouldn't be surprising that self-reliance is high up in the list of top 10 web virtues. The web itself started out as a huge do-it-yourself project, and being able to do your own technical support is a mark of web competency still. More and more, employees and customers want to feel their own hands on the wheel. Another obvious example. In the old days, if you wanted to find some information, you had to go to the corporate information retrieval expert and fill out a form. But now the web has reset expectations. If the data hierophants tell you that you're not trained enough to search the corporate library, you'll reply, "Hey, I just came back from Alta Vista," or Excite or Hotbot or any of the myriad of search sites, "and I searched through hundreds of millions of pages without any training." It's time to hand over the keys to the index. Babies learn to drive. Self-reliance, however, goes far beyond the technical realm. For example, Boeing enables mechanics to order parts themselves through their cleverly named Part Analysis and Requirement Tracking, or PARTS, system, instead of petitioning the purchasing department. And Chrysler encourages employees to make their own travel arrangements via an intranet site that shows them only the appropriate choices. For example, the Concorde doesn't show up as a possibility, saving administrative costs and giving the workers a greater sense, illusion, of control. There's a dark side to self-reliance. It can encourage a type of arrogant cynicism that reacts to anything that the business tries to do for you with, "I can do it better than that." In this view of the world, there's what I can do with my own two hands, and then there's red tape. To the web cult of self-reliance, the business is not only an obstacle, it's them, the other. Yet if we know that routing a customer comment through the standard structures of the fort will result in a content-free form letter being sent out 6 weeks later, we will sit down and bang out an email immediately that actually addresses the customer's concern. Self-reliance breeds disengagement with the business, but more direct engagement with the real work of business. We are seeing, then, a realignment of loyalties, from resting comfortably in the assumed paternalism of Fort Business to an aggressive devotion to making life better for customers. The business isn't a machine anymore. It's a resource I alone and we together can use to make a customer happy. To self@evident.com from clock@panix.com. You write, "The business isn't a machine anymore. It's a resource, stuff that I alone and we together can use to make a customer happy." I'm always a little bothered by this making customers happy trope. Is this really why people try harder in orgs? I tend to doubt it. Maybe it's just me, but I don't think people are too often inspired by customers. That's usually just more happy talk. Instead, workers go the extra mile because they want to do a good job. To me, pride of craftsmanship is a far greater motivator. If I'm interacting with a customer, I want to show that other person that I am a professional, even if the rest of the company is going to hell in a handbasket. And I think this is true right up to the level of the CEO. If you, David Weinberger, want to make your customers happy, I'd say it's more to demonstrate that you're a capable dude, not because you're concerned for your client's mental state. To clock@panix.com from self@evident.com. I think we're probably both right. Yuck. Having customers who are happy to your face is a very big turn-on for a lot of people. You can say that that's only because ultimately it makes me feel competent, but you could reduce all human actions to that and thus obliterate the real distinction between stealing candy from a baby and devoting your life to working with the poor. Hypertime. We all know that internet time is 7 times the speed of normal time. On the internet, everyone knows you don't have time to spell check. It affects our business expectations for internet startups and our expectations about the quality of products we know have been rushed to the market, but there's actually more at stake. In fact, the philosopher Martin Heidegger had it right when he explained that time is at the root of all that is. Business likes to think that it operates on a master schedule that devolves into lots of supporting schedules, just as the corporate strategy devolves into objectives and then into tasks, and just as the org chart foliates into branches, twigs, and finally leaves. In a perfectly run business, all the schedules tick in sync. Tick, tock, tick, tock. Now, we all know that no complex organization works perfectly, so with a knowing smile, we dismiss the possibility, but yet we hold it out as an ideal. Our clocks are supposed to be driven from on high. The web decentralizes time by letting hyperlinked groups form that are driven by their do-it-ourselves zeal to get stuff done now. For these groups, schedules are driven locally, not centrally. The schedules are created by local groups and individuals, accounting for their assessment of what's realistic. And they route around obstacles, not like building straight-line highways where it's assumed that all boulders can be blasted out of the way. Deadlines. But what happens to deadlines if time becomes decentralized? Let me give you an example that I recount with little pride. I was working in a relatively small software company that was, happily, experiencing growing pains as we went from $3 million to $40 million in revenues. I had been one of the 3 members of the executive management team that had agreed to roll the dice that set us off on the steep growth curve. My role was strategist. I was never much of an implementer. But because we now desperately needed to run marketing programs, I agreed to step into the role of VP of marketing. A couple of months later, we hired a chief operating officer to manage our growth. On purpose, he was a countercultural figure in the company, a hard-bitten, ultra-realistic guy with a relentlessly positive attitude applied as a fresco to mask a cracking wall of disagreeable fear. A couple of weeks after arriving, he called me into his office to bond with me and also, not incidentally, to find out when the next wave of marketing materials would be ready. I said I didn't know. "Why not?" he demanded. I replied that I had a really well-motivated team of professionals who were moving heaven and earth to get it all done. It would be done at the earliest possible moment. He looked at me in amazement and gave up on me. Now, I will admit that as COO, he needed to have some sense of the timing of events. For example, he might have needed to know when the materials would be ready because of an upcoming sales meeting. And in such a case, I would have told him what I thought would be ready. And if he wanted it sooner, I would have warned him that some of it would be of poor quality. But in fact, there was no upcoming event. He managed by holding people to deadlines. I managed by holding people to people. His view of me, to this day, is that I am an unrealistic, soft-edged, namby-pamby, probably borderline homosexual type of guy. My view of him is that he's an unrealistic, anal-retentive, power-driven, frightened little boy. You know, but underneath it all, we actually don't like each other. Is one of us more realistic than the other? I don't think so. If not living by deadlines is unrealistic, it's just as unrealistic to think that a motivated group of people, working hard, will get things done by a particular moment just because you set that moment as the end point. Clearly, there's room for both personality types. Gosh, I am namby-pamby, aren't I? But since the deadline drivers always get to state their point of view, let's for once not assume that deadlines are the only way to manage, and that people who miss deadlines are like dawdling children who need to be sent to the corner of the org chart where they can sit to think about what they've done. Instead, let's leave open the possibility that deadlines are frequently a weapon used by managers who assume that workers are basically slackers. In fact, hyperlinked teams, ruled by the laws of connection, are motivated by a genuine desire to turn out a product or help a customer. They will work as hard as they can to do right by their customers and their coworkers. They know better than anyone, in many instances, when the work can realistically be finished. Managing them simply means asking them. Realism equals pessimism. It's time to take reality back from the bottom line crowd. When they say, be realistic, they mean, assume the worst, be pessimistic. If someone has underestimated sales potential, no one calls out the ultimate put-down, be realistic. The web itself was not a realistic proposition. The world's largest network created without management or control? The web is as implausible as a bumblebee flying. Both are flat impossibilities. Businesses that define realism as pessimism will miss all the interesting opportunities. Personal work time. The decentralization of time creates other ripples. When you allow people to control their own schedules, they don't always cut their day into clean work and non-work time periods. Their personal lives begin to invade Fort Business. They know that even if they leave for an hour for the Good News Assembly at their child's elementary school, they still can get done what needs doing, even if it means working at home over the weekend. Once the time wall is breached, it rapidly becomes more and more permeable. If the only time I can make calls to further the process of adopting a child is during work hours, I will make those calls. If the only time I can talk with a travel agent to plan my vacation is between 9 and 5, I will call the travel agent during work. And, of course, the web makes it easier than ever for me to permeate my work time with personal errands and concerns. Now, the fact is that office workers have always ignored the temporal walls and called the adoption agency and the travel agency during work hours. We've just had to lie and pretend. Sorry to have a life, sir. It won't happen again, sir. Some businesses have started to recognize that the temporal walls are full of windows. For example, Aetna realized that their workers inevitably spend time at work on personal issues. And what sort of fish-hearted bastard would tell them not to? So Aetna built into its intranet the sort of information they thought employees were looking for. You can get information about how to adopt a child, for example, or how to arrange for a college scholarship for your kids. Since people are going to spend business time doing that anyway, why not make it easier for them by including the information on the corporate intranet? Yes, doing this had a practical purpose that speaks to the bottom line guys because it meant employees were spending less time on non-business issues. But you don't need bottom line reasons to do this type of thing if we take as a basic business principle that companies need to wake up and smell the coffee. The walls around Fort Business may have inscribed in them, "Let all who enter here abandon all personal life," but only the truly pathetic pay it any mind. Therefore, you might as well drop the pretense. Skimming time. Let's review, shall we? The web's decentralization of time breaks apart the master schedule that supposedly has us ticking and talking in unison, using artificial deadlines to enforce the corporate will. And personal time infects the purity of our time working behind the fort walls. One more thing. The web changes time from sequential to random. If you already know what random access is, feel free to jump over this paragraph, but not before snickering at its witty self-reference. For example, audio is a sequential medium because you can only get from point A to point C by causing point B to pass the tape heads. CDs, DVDs, and hard drives are random access devices because you can hop all around on them. The web is, generally, random. You're expected to hyperlink around, sampling what you like. Random access spoils you. Instead of having to wait around for the tape to play out, you can skip right to the parts that you care about. That also means each person's experience of the tape may be different. The web is making us impatient with anything we can't skim. This includes 67-slide PowerPoint presentations, almost all meetings, being put on hold when you place a call that an adequate website would have made unnecessary, canned online tutorials, managers who hand you a copy of a report and then insist on telling you everything that's in it, television without a remote, traveling, bores. The point? Web time isn't just 7 times faster than normal time, it's also 1,000 times more random, in the good sense. Open access to everything. When it comes to information, the web's impulse is the opposite of fort businesses. The fort views information access as a publishing process, pushing to the appropriate people precisely the information they need at the right time. The publisher will ascertain your information needs. Your job is to sit back, relax, and open wide. This model made sense when information was scarce, and it made sense when business could take itself seriously as an omniscient potentate. That was then. Now employees want to be able to run barefoot through the tall grass of information, and not simply because we're in a self-reliant sort of mood. It's one thing to ask an information retrieval specialist to look up some data in a sanctified database where all the data is assumed to be approved and certified. It's another to try to gather competitive information from the web where you're reading corporate BS from competitors, whining complaints on Usenet, reports from self-proclaimed industry experts, like some of us ClueTrain authors, and libelous comments from anonymous stock manipulators. In this environment, making judgments about what counts is a honed skill, one as personal as writing well or having a sense of humor. It is not something we're willing to delegate to others. But the Central Committee says that it must control all access because it can't afford to let out state secrets. Imagine if our competitors got their hands on that stuff. Sure, there are some trade secrets so important that you need to transport them in briefcases chained to some treasured bodily appendage. Coke's secret formula, a new molecule developed by a bioengineering company, the stocks a mutual fund company is about to invest in. But those are the exceptions. To talk about the role of secrecy in terms of those types of secrets is like evaluating the rural lifestyle by taking Ted Kaczynski's cabin as your example. And there's a price to assuming that secrecy is normal, that everything is to be kept secret unless otherwise noted. Not only do you have the expense of keeping the secret, but you lose the value of information. Information by its nature only has value insofar as it's known. And when combined with smart people with an impulse to solve problems and exploit opportunities, information increases its value. The CIA and secrets. Maybe 10 years ago, I heard a tale about the CIA. The agency went on a declassification rampage. It seems that, because the rules of declassification had been so broadly delimited and the penalties for non-compliance were terrifying, nearly everything for the previous several decades had been classified top secret. Therefore, the agency didn't know what was really top secret anymore. Phone numbers to order in pizza were filed along with the number of the Kremlin hotline. Because of fear, the categorization of the information had become practically worthless. Christopher Locke. Information wants to be free, sure, but it wants to be free because it wants to find other ideas, copulate, and spawn whole broods of new ideas. Controlling information is like trying to control a conversation. It can't be done and still be genuine. You're not publishing information. You're building a kitchen. You're planting a field. People wander around in information and learn where to find the stuff that counts, the stuff that's wrong in enlightening ways, the stuff that's purposefully off base, the stuff that's fun, the stuff that's ludicrous. Let's look at one specific type of information that needs to be free: documents. Heroic documents. Business currently has a heroic view of documents. When we're given an assignment, should we do this merger? We need to plan for moving into the new office space. We go to our cubicle and put our heads down for a day, a week, a fortnight. We go through as many drafts as we have to until we have a killer document, a report or an overhead presentation, typically, that nails it all down, comes to conclusions, and is irrefutable. Then we go to the big meeting and slap it down like Beowulf slaying Grendel. Here I stand, we declare, bravado masking our anxiety. And if someone calls our bluff, if someone says, you seem not to have consulted the study the Gartner Group did last quarter, or you haven't considered the impact of the dilution of their shares, you simply are not permitted to say, whoops, can I just have those copies back? You're toast, you're dead meat, you've had your head handed to you. What's gone wrong here is time. Because we are geared toward heroic presentations, we keep our work under wraps until we go public with it, that is, publish it, at the big meeting. Until that moment, no one is allowed to look at it without our permission. It is secret. But the web is changing this. There's already software that lets groups work together on documents over intranets, and that capability is being built into the word processors themselves so that it'll be as easy to post a draft to a shared web space as it is to send it to be sprayed on paper. So you'll be given an assignment, and just as before, you'll retire to your cubicle, but only for about half an hour. You'll write up some initial ideas, post them to the intranet, this feels like saving them into a shared folder, and you'll send out mail to the people you think can help you with this. Here's how much attention you'll pay to where those people are located in the org chart. Zero. Your email will say, and I quote, "Old Man Withers wants me to solve the Parcheesi problem in Tahiti by next month. Yikes! So I posted a couple of ideas at https://rsmythe.megacorp.com/Parcheesi. I also put in some links to Donnerby's bogus report from last year, the one that didn't see the crisis coming. You can always count on Donkey Balls. There are also some links to a couple of sites I found when I did a search at the usual suspect search sites. Let me know what you think, and remember, the doc I posted is just a bunch of BS. Kick it around, and let's get this thing going. Thanks, guys and gals. Use the greatest." This may not sound revolutionary, but consider. People used to keep their drafts secret for fear of looking like idiots, but now they post them and acknowledge they may be completely wrong. Work has gone from an individual task to a group task. The old model of keeping drafts secret until the moment of publication has been broken. Ideas are now public from their inception. Ideas are assumed to be given out freely rather than hoarded. People are brought in not because they are in a chain of command, but because they have necessary skills, share interests, and are fun to work with. Sober-sided reports that were the mark of professionalism are often replaced by humor-filled interchanges. Where do secrets fit into this picture? Fear of letting information out would cripple this project. The report that would emerge would be far inferior to what arises from a free interchange of ideas. Besides, the web lets everyone talk to everyone, in every department, across divisions, with strategic customers and even competitors. There are no secrets. Decisions, decisions. Of course, you're not providing open access simply to fill people's heads with scurrilous thoughts and titillating tidbits. You want people to make better decisions. But open access to information also means that you've undercut your normal decision-making process. Why do we have a decision chain in the first place? Ostensibly, it's because those up the org chart have a wider view as well as more experience. There is something to be said for experience, although it can thicken the skin as well as ennoble the mind. But if everyone has access to information, those on top no longer necessarily have the widest view. Being close to the customer and being in constant interaction with one's suppliers may bring an equally deep view into the business and its real possibilities. Decisions are centralized also to enable accountability, praise for success, condemnation for failure. But every team member recognizes, and often resents, this fiction. I sat through an off-site meeting once at which the middle managers were handed cross pens to reward them for their success, but really to buy loyalty to the man handing them out. Afterwards, one of the managers told me he felt dirty. Though his team had done the work, he got the pen. The pen was now a symbol of what he hated about his job. He would pass along the praise, of course, but clearly, he thought, senior management didn't appreciate how hard the team had worked. Being appreciated is not a commutative property. It requires eye contact, not the ritualistic passing of pens. And, of course, if the teams had failed, the senior executive accountable for the failure would have passed the criticism down and, not to be cynical, would likely find a way to dodge the bullet. Does this mean that every decision will be collaborative? Of course not. But neither will every decision be taken by an individual. We have a rich heritage on which to draw. Our culture has evolved many ways of making decisions.